We're checking in on local efforts to prepare for climate change in Monroe County. That's in the southwest portion of our state in the Driftless area. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Over the past about a dozen years or so, Monroe County has experienced an increase in extreme rains. Severe flooding in 2018, it caused multiple dam failures. It was a wake-up call, and the county formed a climate change task force. How has climate change affected your community? Local leaders, how are you struggling to find ways to address severe weather events? Can you get buy-in on your plans? 800-642-1234. Bob McKeel is director of Monroe County Land Conservation Department. Bob, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. It's great to be back and discuss the Monroe County Climate Change Task Force.
Well, take us back in time to the time when the task force formed. You know, dams break in 2018. This is a very severe situation. How did the county make that decision to tackle climate change?
Well, it's I would say it's an accumulation of storm damage over, I always go back to 2007. It seems like there's a continual pattern, at least in the southern portion of Monroe County on the Vernon County line. But this has been going on for a while. We've had at least 20 some events in the Driftless area, not all in Monroe County, that has affected us. If it doesn't hit a community with a large population, you probably don't hear about it. But there's still a lot of lives affected with these storm events. And so 2018 is the one that everybody saw nationally. A lot of communities affected, a lot of dams breached during that event. But really in 2019, we had the same trend three times again. Again, it didn't hit a large community, but there was some huge amount of damage to agriculture. And at that point, I knew we had to do something different. And working with the county administrator, county board chair, that's when we decided to form the Climate Change Task Force, assemble a team of experts, residents, landowners, unique groups, and come to the table and have this discussion.
Yeah, so it looks like you have 16 members on this task force. You meet once a month, is that right?
That's correct, once a month. And we also try to bring in expertise because climate change is, for the most part, there's more questions than answers. And so we're always trying to bring outside expertise in to educate us and steer us in directions of positive impact on the landscape.
And a lot of what you're doing is also gathering data, gathering information. Why is that data important for your long-term plan?
So the data collection that we're involved with is really about the rainfall intensity. Collecting precipitation, trying to figure out what that intensity rate is, along with putting sensors in the streams. And these sensors monitor the depth on a 15-minute interval. And so we can kind of tie the precipitation intensity to what's happening to the streams. And we can determine what kind of reaction or how our conservation practices may be functioning or infrastructure is functioning to certain storm events. Along with the most important thing is we need to do a better job of warning the public to keep them out of harm's way.
Yeah, how do those hydrology numbers and those facts then inform how you talk with residents about this?
And so most of the residents, again, we've had a lot of events, so they know that this is an issue. And they're more than willing to participate and help us get to that point where we're getting more sensors on the landscape. We even have created a donation fund. We have quite a few residents that have contributed, businesses that have contributed dollars to these sensors, because it's all about information. You can't react without information and scientific information. So we're working on that end. We're also working with the National Weather Service. They're creating a southwestern hydraulic or hydrology monitoring page, so the public would have access to that beyond the warnings, so they can keep a pulse on the sensors that affect their watershed.
We're talking with Bob McKeel, director of Monroe County Land Conservation Department. He's a member of the county's Climate Change Task Force. You can join in. Have you seen climate change affect your community? What questions do you have about local solutions, local action? Join in at 800-642-1234. Bob, Governor Evers had included money in his budget proposal for exactly the kind of thing you're doing in Monroe County. It was stripped out by Republican lawmakers. So in not having that state support, how is Monroe County funding this work on climate change?
Unfortunately, it was struck out of the budget moving forward. I can vouch that it is easily a full-time position in a county to tackle this challenge. As far as Monroe County, how are we handling it? We are picking up the slack wherever we can get our professionals to step forward in Monroe County, and we have support of our county administrator and county board. So for instance, I have a land use planner, we have the zoning administrator, the forester. They're all coming forward, the GIS specialists contributing time to this effort, along with all the elected officials and other professionals coming to the table.
You're also talking with some homeowners who are in the floodway. Their homes are at risk. What is it like to talk with them about moving?
So we're fortunate enough to secure some grant funding through FEMA Hazard Mitigation Program, along with the DNR Municipal Flood Control Grant and Community Development Block Grant Program. So the focus or the target is these residents that are in the floodway, been subject to chronic flooding. Their house or basement will get flooded. For instance, in 2018, they get money to rebuild, get their home back up to what they remember, and it gets hit again the following year. So that's what we targeted, and really it's an easy sell when you can offer them dollars to buy them out so they can retain that value and go somewhere else, because it's when the thunder starts booming and the lightning and they know there's another storm event in the watershed, it gets pretty uneasy to go to sleep right next to a river or a stream that consistently hits your house. So we've got 8 or 9 homes that we're working with as far as demoing and removing from the floodplain and returning it to green space.
What is happening to your floodplains? Are they filling up with water?
So the floodplains, for the most part, over time, I would say before, you know, the last 10, 15 years, says humans have gotten comfortable occupying that area. So whether it's homes or infrastructure, agriculture, farming next to the stream. And what we're finding is nature is trying to reclaim that valley floor. It is flat for a reason. Water, it is to contain the water during these flood events. And so we need to recognize that and help people make better decisions in that corridor.
Bob McKeel is director of Monroe County Land Conservation Department, part of the county's Climate Change Task Force. We're discussing climate change, how one county, Monroe, in southwest Wisconsin is confronting it. How is your county dealing with this? Are your residents wondering how to handle repairing roads, bridges, relocating households out of floodplains? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment for more conversation on climate change here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're checking in on the work of Monroe County's Climate Change Task Force, the 16-member group. It meets once a month. They kicked off their climate readiness and rural economic opportunity assessment this month, an 8-month project to study the effects of climate change, make recommendations for what they call resiliency plans. Is your county studying the local effects of climate change? What have you learned? How has your community been affected by storms? Did a dam give way? What was that like? Join in 800-642-1234. Bob McKeel is the county's Land Conservation Department Director and on the Climate Change Task Force. He's with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Brett now, joining us from Norwalk. Hi, Brett. Go ahead.
Good morning. I had a comment and a question. Basing some of my suppositions off of the Alan Savory Institute, he has about a 20-minute TED Talk that would be able to share what I'm thinking a lot better than I can. But I just wondered, is there any discussion of financial economic encouragement of rotational grazing and some of the benefits of sequestering carbon in the soil, especially in an area like the Driftless in southern Monroe County, where we can get huge amounts of rain per year, but safely manage that in a grassland situation with rotational grazing?
Brett, thank you. What are your insights there, Bob?
Yes, that's a good point. And as far as this project that we're involved with Wisconsin Greenfire, we've broken it out into four sub-teams, and one of those is the agricultural sub-team, and that is to focus on what are our mitigation options or opportunities. And so rotational grazing or managed grazing is one of those as we move forward, just as long as, you know, the other parts are implementing buffer strips or native grasses or tree plantings, type of cover crops you're using in your rotation. But yes, grazing is one of those key components, and that will be a point where we need to get dollars out there to cost share to help landowners make those changes. So yes, good point.
And quantifying carbon credits, how would this help, with the climate change?
So again, there's more questions in the climate change world as far as carbon stocks and mitigating or sequestering carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the one thing we need to learn in Wisconsin is what practices give us the most gain in agriculture as far as sequestering carbon. And we do have dollars or grant through the Department of Ag to actually put some demonstrations out there and learn from that and put numbers to it to quantify it. So by the end of next year, we're hopeful that we can share numbers and point the direction to what practices give us the most bang for our buck when it comes to climate change mitigation.
Well, let's look more closely at infrastructure. How are you working on upgrading roads, bridges, how infrastructure works in your county as you look at these severe rain events?
So our infrastructure, of course, is composed of municipalities from the towns. We have 24 townships. We have the county highway department and obviously the state highways. Our infrastructure in the southern part of the county is really taking a beating, specifically in the town level. The size of the structures, if they're perched, their condition is really getting hammered. And so we've had a discussion about how can we do an assessment or an inventory of all the crossings, which are culverts and bridges in the county, to rank them and put them in an order of climate resiliency or fish passage and condition, and get funding targeted to those worst case scenarios. So this year we actually have hired two interns that they'll be, their focus is to start that inventory assessment process in the southern part of the county and slowly work north, realizing we have over 1,700 crossings.
Wow.
In Monroe County that we have to evaluate.
Yeah, that's a lot. That'll be quite a bit of inventory for those interns to tackle.
I haven't told them yet.
We're talking with Monroe County Land Conservation Department Director Bob McKeel. We're learning how the county is taking a proactive approach to climate change after severe flooding through the years. You can join in. Have you incurred flooding in recent years? Is that related to an infrastructure failure? How has the increased intensity of storms impacted your land, your home, your roads, your culverts? 800-642-1234. I'm wondering, Bob, Fort McCoy, the Army installation between Sparta and Tomah, is in Monroe County. How are you involving Fort McCoy in your planning?
Fort McCoy has always been a great partner for us at the county level, whether it's sharing ideas or information or labor, working on a stream project, so their natural resource department, along with plenty of information sharing between the county and the installation. But they are a partner sitting at the table in the Climate Change Task Force. So they're marching right with us. And they're also a part of the team with this Green Fire Project doing this assessment. So they're 60,000 acres of Monroe County's 580,000, and they're a key partner. So what we're doing, they'll be trying to implement at the installation as we go forward. So we're working without boundaries in the county, and we need to also look at our area. You know, Monroe County's leading this effort, but water travels through boundary municipal boundaries, it travels through watersheds, and everybody's affected. So that's the unique part. People are paying attention, people are participating, so which is great.
And when you say that the Green Fire Project, is this an advocacy group? How is it working in tandem with the Climate Change Task Force?
So the Wisconsin Green Fire is the expertise, or the
Okay.
retired a lot of DNR science world type people, the professionals that have collaborated, and we have a couple folks from the Wisconsin Green Fire that are leading the Monroe County Climate Readiness and Rural Economic Opportunity Assessment. They're coordinating this effort and bringing all this outside expertise. They're very good at networking and knowing who to specialize in certain areas related to the four sub-teams we have formed to address climate change.
Yeah, so they're kind of like your greater consultants as you go about this work.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to view it.
You know, Bob, climate change is happening. Your county believes that, but how fast can you move on adapting because you have all these objectives? Are your plans achievable in amount of time that you can avoid another crisis?
So our 10 objectives that we put together, there was 10 of them, and so the order is based on how quick we can implement or address that situation. And so the first and foremost was to alert and keep people out of harm's way, or out of the floodway. And we're doing that right now. Second, mitigate intense rain events on the landscape, manage the runoff. And the last one, which is the most difficult one, to change human behavior on the landscape to address the cause or climate change. And so the Green Fire Project is going to point all the arrows and offer opportunity and options to address climate change. We're doing everything we can to get to that point. And on the first three points that I talked about is, the warning systems, getting that out there, mitigate intense rain events on the landscape. And we can do that. We have the tools as conservationists to do that, along with managing runoff. At a certain point, though, some of these rain events, we can't design our way out of. They're too big of an event. So the best thing we can do is stay out of its way.
What have you learned by having so many different voices at the table and different priorities at the table?
I think the bottom line is for everybody that participates or questions or calls, that is interest and people acknowledging that there is a lot of change going on in the landscape. And so how do you harness that energy and make change? And that's the largest challenge because, like you said, there's a lot of different viewpoints coming to the table. So shaping that to make positive change is probably the hardest task that we're dealing with. But we're bringing in as many expertise or experts that we can help guide us and lead us through this change and start creating change for the positive.
Keith is with us from Toma. Hi, Keith, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I have my comment is that I feel that the emphasis is put on the lakes and the streams, whereas I believe the emphasis should be put on the actual watershed. Each watershed should be evaluated, and there's farming practices in Monroe County that's mostly soybean and corn, which does very little to retain water, maybe an inch of water, rainwater an hour. Whereas if you planted a root crop, you could advance that to maybe 20 inches an hour. So I think the problem is the source. The source is the farmer.
Keith, thank you. Bob, short on time, your thoughts?
Yep. So Keith brings up a good point. In agriculture, there's been a huge shift. And that shift is the loss of the dairy industry over the last 5 to 10 years. So with that, that hay that's that perennial crop in the rotation is now corn and beans. And then you pair that with the climate change symptoms of intense and heavy rains has increased the amount of erosion, severity of these storm events, and that runoff he was alluding to. So very good point, Keith.
Bob, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and always willing to talk about Monroe County's efforts.
Bob McKeel, Director of Monroe County Land Conservation Department. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about investigating PPP loans on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Congress's major COVID relief program for small businesses last year was the Paycheck Protection Program, PPP loans. The Small Business Administration has released new details on the more than 11.8 million PPP loans, a nearly $800 billion COVID relief program. But investigative journalists earlier this year who crunched the numbers found racial disparities in who received the loans. Are you a business owner who applied for a PPP loan? Did you have difficulty getting it? Did you reapply? What did you learn through the process? 800-642-1234. Laura Morrell is a reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Laura, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you give us some nuts and bolts first on how the SBA, the U.S. Small Business Administration, set up the PPP loan program to work?
Sure. So the Federal Paycheck Protection Program, first of all, is one of the largest financial bailouts since the Great Depression. And it was signed into law on March 27th last year. And the way that it was set up under the CARES Act, Congress had ordered the SBA and the Treasury Department to issue guidance to lenders to make sure that the program would prioritize small businesses, especially businesses in underserved communities and in rural areas. But our analysis found widespread disparities in how the loans were distributed, even though this guidance was something that was written as part of a law of the CARES Act. And what we found is that our data team did an analysis of more than 5 million PPP loans that were issued last year. And we found that in the vast majority of metro areas with a population of 1 million or more, the rate of lending to majority white communities was far higher than the rates for any majority Latinx, Black, or Asian areas. And in a lot of places, these disparities were really extreme, including in Los Angeles, New York City, Dallas, Phoenix, and Las Vegas.
I wonder how you trace the dollars through the demographics, because I noticed that when the SBA charted out its demographics for this program, there was so much in the unknown, not stated, or unanswered categories. How could you decipher when gender, race, and ethnicity or veteran status wasn't really identified in the loan process?
That's a great question. Under the Trump administration, that administration failed to collect demographic information from PPP applicants, which made it extremely difficult to figure out exactly which businesses the loans went to and in which communities. And so what our data team did was that it looked at how loans were distributed at the census tract level across racial groups. And this took months. And it's something that we were able to do for every census tract in the U.S. And that way we were able to compare different census tracts and get a sense of the percentage rate of businesses that were distributed or approved within those communities. So that was how we were able to conduct this analysis, even though the Trump administration barely collected any data that would have supported any kind of analysis like this.
So you mean you're overlaying the census data to kind of get a benchmark for then with the data that you have from the SBA?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, another issue here is the banks. JP Morgan Chase and Bank of America alone distributed $21 billion through this loan program, more than 300,000 loans approved. What role did big banks have in the disparities you found?
Well, one thing that's really important to note is that lenders had to prepare for this avalanche of applications at the beginning of PPP when everyone was rushing to apply for relief without any written guidance from the SBA. The SBA was still issuing guidelines while lenders were already receiving applications. And so that rush widens the gap between who was approved and declined, because any sort of obstacle like missing paperwork or, you know, confusion with the online application portals risk leaving businesses last in line. And we also cited this congressional report that came out late last year, which sharply criticized the program's implementation. This congressional subcommittee found that Treasury officials told the American Bankers Association to tell its members, so predominantly big lenders, to direct PPP lending to existing customers. Hmm. And that was a huge barrier to businesses who don't have a strong existing relationship with the bank. And unfortunately, those were often businesses in communities of color.
Was this money getting to the smallest of small businesses?
In the beginning, it was not. You know, we talked to sole proprietors, and these are the smallest of businesses that are essentially run by one person. And, you know, there was a lot of confusion around the messaging of the program, since the program itself was called the Paycheck Protection Program. A lot of these really small business owners thought that they assumed that they didn't qualify because they didn't have anyone on payroll. And it wasn't really until the second round, which was last summer, and then earlier this year during the third round, that, you know, that messaging was somewhat corrected. And so proprietors were able to apply for that relief. We also talked to business owners who hesitated to take out a loan, even if these were forgivable loans, in the middle of all of this economic uncertainty. They just had no idea if they would be able to pay it back or if they were even going to stay open. And then there are other barriers too. You know, the lack of technology that a lot of small business owners face. Not everybody has scanners or computers, especially at home during lockdown. So it was hard for a lot of people to send documents to banks.
Yeah. With sole proprietors, studies show that 96% of Black-owned businesses are sole proprietors.
Yes, that's true. And we talked to a lot of Black business owners, including one business owner in Los Angeles, Annie Graham, whose experience just completely illustrates the disparities within this program. She first tried applying through Wells Fargo, which has been her bank for many years, and was really confused by their application process. So she was never able to submit an application. And then during the second round of PPP, she heard of this company called MBE Capital Partners that had gotten help from Magic Johnson to provide PPP loans to businesses and communities of color. So she applied through them, but this bank was asking her for these payroll documents that she wouldn't have because she's a sole proprietor. She doesn't have anyone on payroll. So they declined her application, and she wasn't able to get relief until this year, this third round, when she applied through a financial institution that was helping a lot of business owners of color get help. And she was finally approved a year after she had started applying for PPP for relief.
And Annie Graham's story, her situation, is not an isolated incident. You know, Annie was also talking about her fellow business owners in her community who were in the same boat, same situation.
Yeah, same situation. She walked with us along her street in the city of Inglewood near Los Angeles and pointed out all the businesses that, she also had heard were struggling during this time to get relief. And we also talked to businesses in that area and in other communities near her and heard the same stories over and over again. A lot of these businesses tried to apply with their own banks, with big lenders. But just didn't get the help that they needed. They either never heard back from the banks or they were just denied and never really got a clear explanation as to why.
Laura Morrell is with us, a reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. She's giving us takeaways from their analysis on PPP loans, the federal government's program to help businesses keep their workforce employed during the COVID crisis. You can join in. Are you a business owner who applied for PPP loans? Did you have difficulties accessing the first round, second round? How could the Paycheck Protection Program have been improved? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Laura, did the sudden closure of the PPP loan program at the end of May, did that cause challenges for small businesses hoping to secure funding when they didn't get funding in the first round?
I heard anecdotally that a lot of businesses were able to get help through community development financial institutions, and these are institutions that primarily cater to lower income neighborhoods or communities of color. And they really rushed to push a lot of applications during this latest round. So I didn't hear too much about challenges in the last few weeks of the program.
What about the experts saying this is an example of modern day redlining, of how it was like in housing segregation? Can you draw parallels there?
Yes, that's a great point. Congress back in the 1930s, they established the Federal Housing Administration, and the FHA was in charge of facilitating mortgage lending. But what ended up happening was that the agency was refusing to insure mortgages in predominantly Black neighborhoods, which resulted in the term that we know today called redlining. And redlining was never completely reversed. Congress passed the Community Reinvestment Act in 1977, but it didn't have strong enforcement mechanisms. And in fact, a few years ago, Reveal found that Black and Latinx households were still denied mortgages at far higher rates than their white counterparts. But despite the banking system's consistent failures in serving communities of color, Congress still designed PPP to run through commercial lenders. And so we spoke to one expert who told us, when you have a crisis like COVID and you say, okay, we're going to put together a recovery program, and then you run that recovery program through the same system that for generations has consistently shown that, there are racial disparities within it, you're going to see the same results. You're not going to see an equitable recovery.
Laura Morrell is a reporter with Reveal as we discuss PPP loans, the federal loan program that closed at the end of May. If you sought a PPP loan and were successful, are you trying to get PPP loan forgiveness? Where are you at with that? How could the program have been improved? What did you think of the big banks like JPMorgan Chase and Bank of America that doled out billions of dollars in this program? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back in a minute with Laura Morrell here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin small businesses received nearly $4.4 billion through the duration of the SBA's Paycheck Protection Program, PPP loans. More than 100,000 loans were approved in our state in all. That's from the most recent SBA report published in June on its PPP loan program that closed at the end of May. Did your business receive a loan? What was the process like? Are you trying to get forgiveness? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Laura Morrell is a reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. She's with us for about 10 more minutes. Laura, in terms of the disparities that Reveal found, what have the banks said about these disparities?
So we were able to do an interview with one of the executives at Bank of America, which, as you know, is the largest PPP lender. And we were able to talk to them and ask them about these disparities that we found. And they told us that, you know, it wasn't necessarily their fault that these disparities happened. They recognized that the Paycheck Protection Program was designed to primarily help businesses that have employees. And they said that the reason behind that was so that employers could help employees stay on payroll and make sure that they didn't end up in unemployment. So they blamed the design of the program. But when we talked to experts, equitable lending experts about this, they told us that while it's true that perhaps the program was initially unfavorable to sole proprietors and small businesses, primarily in communities of color, it's also fair to say that there were problems in the way banks were implementing the program. And that goes back to what I said earlier about banks prioritizing clients that they had an existing relationship with. We also spoke to one small bank, MBE Capital Partners, who told us that they were just overwhelmed with the number of applications that they got and that they couldn't jump on the phone and walk every client through the process. And JP Morgan Chase actually acknowledged that the bank prioritized existing customers and told us that, you know, under the program rules, the most efficient way to get funds to as many struggling businesses as possible was to initially focus on existing clients that had a business deposit account with them.
So it was just like this triage process is, you know, a part of a system overload issue. You know, earlier this year, Laura, the Biden administration pledged to be better, to do more to reach Black and Latin-owned businesses, including setting aside for small lenders to access the PPP portal and seek out the smallest business owners. Has any of this come to fruition?
Yeah, we've heard anecdotally that businesses in communities of color did see improvements or, you know, did have better access to PPP with these changes that the Biden administration rolled out earlier this year. I will also note that the SBA decided not to comment on our analysis because they said that they don't comment on third-party analysis, but they did send us a list of all of the policies made in the last few, you know, earlier this year. And that included establishing a 14-day exclusive application period that prioritized businesses with fewer than 20 employees. And we know that by March 5th of this year, businesses in communities of color, those loan approvals actually increased by 20%, according to the SBA. We also learned that sole proprietors were able to apply with gross income instead of net. And that's a huge change because that meant that they would get larger loan amounts. We also learned that immigrant business owners who applied or who filed taxes with ITIN numbers could now apply for the program. During the Trump administration, they were completely excluded from qualifying for PPP. So those were some of the bigger changes that we heard of and that we heard through sources were making a difference in who was qualifying for PPP and getting help.
So those are significant changes. What have you learned on the forgiveness front? What is the process like to apply for loan forgiveness and who's getting it?
Yeah, that's an ongoing part of all of this that we're definitely following and will be following, you know, for the rest of this year as the forgiveness program rolls out. I know that, you know, without getting like too nitty gritty, forgiveness process is kind of complicated. Like there's several different criteria that business owners have to sort of check off on their list in order to qualify for forgiveness. One of those things earlier on, and I'm not sure if this was something that has changed recently under Biden, but you had to use a certain percentage of your loan for payroll.
60%.
Yes, 60%. And so in the beginning, that was unfavorable to sole proprietors who don't have payroll, again. So who would have, you know, done better to, it would have been better for them to use that money, you know, for rent, for instance, or for utility bills, you know, things to keep their business running. But because of those requirements, they were probably less likely to qualify for forgiveness down the road. I do also know that the SBA has created a portal, a forgiveness portal, to make it easier and more accessible for anyone to apply for forgiveness. So that rollout is something that we'll be following.
Yeah, so that portal would mean that you would go directly through the SBA and not through your bank. Is that right?
That's right. Although I have seen a few news stories that say some banks do not want to use this portal and instead are asking their clients to go through their own portals instead. And I could see how perhaps that might cause some confusion down the line. But I think we'll have a better, clearer picture of, you know, the ramifications here in the next few months.
Laura Morrell is with us, reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. She gives us takeaways and what she found investigating the PPP loan program in the pandemic. You can join in. Who do you think is responsible for the PPP program's racial disparities in lending? How could this program have been improved? And were you a PPP loan recipient? What was the process like? 800-642-1234. We heard from Chris in Columbus, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Chris says this conversation reminds them of problems with the federal government and student loan repayment. Laura, are the issues in PPP happening elsewhere in the federal government?
That's a great question. You know, I think, you know, this systemic disparities that we saw in the PPP program, you know, definitely play out in other parts of our government. I mean, we've seen it in the last couple of years in terms of law enforcement and issues raised in regards to how police departments work. So, yeah, I think for sure, you know, this issue of racial disparities is something that we'll continue to see, not just in PPP, but I'm sure in future programs as well.
And along the lines of Chris here, the SBA has other relief programs in its portfolio, the Targeted Economic Injury Disaster Loan Advance Program, the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. Have these programs been discriminatory?
That's another thing that I'm glad you brought it up, because the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program, one thing that we heard a lot from business owners that did not get PPP was that they applied for the Economic Disaster Loan Program and they were approved. But the problem with that is that those loans are not forgivable. So these are business owners that are going to be paying off these loans. In some cases, these are six-figure loans. I know of one business owner, I think it was like $105,000, who will be paying off this money for years to come. And there's no opportunity whatsoever for forgiveness. So because they couldn't get PPP for whatever reason, they are now saddled with this debt for the foreseeable future. So that's another, you know, disparity that we heard of relatively frequently while we were reporting on this. In terms of the restaurant program, we haven't looked into that one too much yet, but it is something that's on our radar.
Laura, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Laura Morrell is a reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. We have links to the investigation by Reveal at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, another edition of our weekly Ask a Contractor series. We get tips and DIY advice on home landscaping. What are you working on in the backyard? Bring your stories, your questions to the conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.